This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, I'm Glenn Pugh for avweb.com. Despite constant technological progress, there is one area of flight that has demonstrably regressed over the last decade, and that is the area of available commercial supersonic transportation. The segment is confronted with financial, aerodynamic, and environmental challenges, but researchers at the University of Miami have taken an unorthodox approach that aims to mate near-zero sonic boom, low drag, and good subsonic performance. We're speaking today with Gaisheng Jia, associate professor at the University of Miami's Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering Department. Gaisheng, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the problems of supersonic aircraft, as I've sort of highlighted, are several. We've got the sonic boom issue, high fuel consumption, generally poor subsonic performance, and, of course, safety issues. Tell me about how those problems manifest in conventional designs.
Well, conventional design, the supersonic airplanes really evolved from subsonic airplanes. So, you know, since Wright Brothers, our airplane wings are always fixed, and we fly in one direction. So, you know, after World War II, you can see that most of the airplanes, since World War I, World War II, the airplanes are symmetric along the longitudinal axis, flying forward. So when we evolved to supersonic, people still following the same trend. And so that's how the Concorde from and SR-71, Blackbirds. You know, when you fly this way, you know, there's a conflict aerodynamically between high speed and the low speed. At the low speed, the airplane, when you go fly too slow, it could stall. So at the low speed, we like to have a large aspect ratio. But at the high speed, and we need a small aspect ratio so that we can have a small wave drag. The conventional airplane, supersonic airplane, trying to make a compromise between high speed and the low speed. So they just do their best. And so in that case, they couldn't give you the optimum performance for supersonic flight. They also couldn't give you the best performance for subsonic flight, but they could train to kind of do a trade between do the best what we can. That's what we have, like a Concorde, SR-71, and the two 144 of Russia's.
Now, we've seen some progress in how designers try to approach these problems. We've seen the implementation of movable wings, and there's been some research with NASA and Gulfstream with quiet spikes. What are the shortcomings there?
Movable wing is one way trying to enhance the subsonic performance. Because, you know, no matter how fast you fly, you have to take off in the landing, which is at a very low speed. And so at the takeoff, they try to stretch the wing out and up to have a high aspect ratio. And when they go to high speed, they sweep the wing back. The disadvantage of this one is that it has to carry a very heavy system for this string wing system. That's a mechanical system for control. You only use it for takeoff, you know, maybe a couple of minutes, but you have to carry for the whole mission. So weight is the enemy of aircraft. It costs a lot of fuel and a lot of other stuff. And also, not just that, even you swing back, you cannot swing too much because there's a limit. Otherwise, you just cannot fly well for subsonic. And the other concept of like a Gulfstream, the quiet spike, they use a very long spike in front trying to weaken a shock, a strong shock to multiple weaker shock. But the problem is the structure stability. Just think, such a long, thin spike, you know, could be easily unstable when you fly. It could generate flutter. And this is kind of drawbacks of the conventional design.
Now, let's talk about your concept in detail. What is the supersonic bidirectional flying wing, and how does it address the basic problems we've outlined?
Okay, the basic idea of a bidirectional flying wing is that it has two directions, as the name said. So, as we said, when we take off, we like to have a high aspect ratio and low sweep angle. And when we go fast, we like the airplane to be slender. So how to take off both? Actually, you know, an easy way is that let's just fly in the airplane in a way, transverse way, with a very high wingspan, high aspect ratio. And when we go to the air, go to high speed, we rotate 90 degrees, and then everything will be okay. Because the sweep angle is basically 90 degrees minus the sweep back angle. So if we have a high sweep angle at supersonic, and then when you go to subsonic, it becomes lower sweep angle. So this basically kind of removes the conflict. So this, since you have to rotate 90 degrees, it will require your platform to be symmetric about two axes. That's the concept.
Now, this 90-degree rotation, I think, may sound very odd to the layman. I count myself as one of them. I had a little bit of a chuckle when I read one of your papers that stated that the rotation was similar to a flying frisbee, which seemed not something that most pilots would want to associate with their flying aircraft. So in reality, in practice, what does that mean? Does your research show the rotation can be achieved safely and also consistently?
Yeah, don't worry, we are not going to keep rotating. So we only rotate a quarter of circle. But the similar principle, like a frisbee, frisbee is flying forward, but at the same time it's also spinning and rotating. So for us, we rotate 90 degrees. So the if the platform is designed symmetric about both axes, that's when we rotate, we still generate lift. And also the rotation, usually it is not should not take too long, so the airplane will just maintain enough lift with the momentum. That's the way. So the for rotations, the moment or torque we will generate from the control surface, like yaw moment.
Another important part of this concept is a low sonic boom. Can you tell me how that's achieved and what some of the key concepts are?
The key concept is that to achieve low sonic boom is that you do not want to generate very strong shockwave. Now, because we can use very high sweep angle, we can use as high as we wish in general. Of course, we have to have enough volume for payload, people, but in general, we can use very high sweep. So in this way, we can actually naturally generate something like quiet spike, but it's very high sweep thin in the front. So this could weaken the shock. And overall, because we can use very high sweep angle, the platform could become very slender, much more slender than the conventional aircraft. For example, conventional aircraft usually do not go, sweep angle do not go to higher than 70 degrees, usually 60 or 70 degrees. But we could go higher. We could go 80. Actually, we begin with 88 degrees. We gradually change to a lower sweep angle. It really helps weaken the sonic boom.
And I understand that, as you're describing, actually, the concept can do away with the familiar tube-style fuselage. From my reading of your material, it sounded like that might be key in helping lower the sonic boom, as it is perceived on the ground, at least. Tell me a little bit about isentropic compression and low wave drag. How do these things factor in with the configuration?
Isentropic compression is that when you fly supersonic, the airflow, when they hit the solid body, they will generate a shockwave. And the shockwave is a compression wave. Ideally, if we can weaken the shockwave to a compression wave, and compression wave, usually we call it isentropic, because shockwave is non-isentropic. So if we can reduce to an isentropic compression wave, the wave in general is very weak. So the way we design, for example, use a flat surface on the bottom, that is the minimum turning angle for a supersonic flight. It's not necessarily always isentropic, but it's close to isentropic.
And that translates to very little shockwave perceived from the bottom side of the aircraft?
Yes. If you we can really achieve isentropic compression wave instead of shockwave, and then there will be no sonic boom.
So when we talk in generalities, what's the reality here? Where are you in testing? Are we just talking about computer models, for example? What have you learned there regarding the feasibility of a real-world prototype?
We have created some prototype. We have done intense computer simulation. So our preliminary simulation show the boom is very low and L over D, basically ratio of lift to drag, is very high. So that means aerodynamic efficiency is high. So the next step is that we will further do some optimization of the configuration, and then we will do mission analysis, and we will do a wind tunnel testing, basically trying to validate the sonic boom and aerodynamic efficiency at the supersonic mode.
Now, if we're allowed to dream, when we put all this into practice, when we combine all the theory and all the testing and create some sort of actual aircraft, what sort of flight times do you imagine such a design could achieve between two cities, and carrying what sort of passenger load with what sort of fuel burn? Are you able to forecast those in rough general terms?
Well, in general, we're talking about when we go to supersonic, for example, if we fly, let's say, Mach 2, will be about three times, slightly lower than three times of the speed of most of the aircraft today. For example, Boeing 737 is about 0.8 Mach number. And we can further go Mach 3, Mach 4, because same concept can go higher Mach number. So in that case, we are talking about, many times of faster than current speed. So let's take two cities between, New York or Tokyo. That's a very long trip. Now we're talking about, 13, 14, 15 hours, and so we can tremendously reduce that to 3-4 hours, or 5 hours, just in that range. Depends on really what's the final peak Mach number you pick.
And you could see that happening with a passenger load of what, maybe 100 passengers, or is it?
We may begin with a business jet. Actually, that's what we are working on now, but the same concept can apply to larger aircraft. That's also one of the configurations we're going to design this time.
That brings me very much to what's next. You mentioned a business jet. I know there's been press reports, speculation about a possible unmanned aerial vehicle. What do you see as the next practical steps in actual production of such an aircraft?
Unmanned air vehicle would be, I would say, has a lower threshold to make, easier to make, because the safety issue is not as stringent as the air vehicle for people. So I would think that would be a very good step to begin with. If we talk about unmanned, I think the development cycle could be a lot shorter. We could talk about, if there's enough money, maybe 5 or 10 years.
We've been speaking with the University of Miami's Gaijing Zha about his research project, the Supersonic Bidirectional Flying Wing. I'm Glenn Pugh for avweb.com. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.